All right. We're going to have a coffee break after the next speaker. The next speaker is Professor Ronald Bracewell of Stanford, who is one of the early ones in Australia and can tell us something about that. Thank you.
I think I can make it work with it.
It's been my fortune every 5 or 10 years to hear Professor Greenstein talk, and I always enjoy it immensely. My duty this morning is to report on some of the doings in Australia in the 1950s. I think this was suggested to me so as not to cause me any embarrassment by having to refer to the 1940s, to which my memory goes back quite well. In fact, my first connection with this whole subject begins with the construction of the Radio Physics Laboratory in 1938. When I used to walk past the great hole in the ground when they were digging the basement on my way as an undergraduate to lectures in the University of Sydney. The Radio Physics Lab was built in 1938 in preparation for the war in the South Pacific. And as time elapsed, radar for various Pacific purposes was developed, such as the lightweight air warning radar, which I will explain my reason for introducing in a moment, which lived in a tent and was portable on men's backs to the top of hills on small islands in the Pacific. The purpose of this radar was to measure the height of incoming aircraft. You understand that with radar one can easily measure the range and the azimuth, but if the radar reports that there's an attack by enemy aircraft approaching, then it's not sufficient to fly out to the indicated range and azimuth. You have to arrive there at the correct height. It might be 30,000 feet, 20,000 feet, 10,000 feet, or it might be 1,000 feet. So you have to be there in the right place because there might maybe cloud layers intervening. So height finding became one of the important problems that the Radio Physics Laboratory in Sydney was working on. Now, as the end of the war approached, the staff began to worry about what they would do when the war ended. Unlike the situation in the United States and Great Britain, where scientists had been brought in from jobs that they already had to work on national problems, in Australia, the people did not have jobs. They had been suddenly created out of nothing, such as myself at an extremely early age. And we had nowhere to go, so a lot of thought was given to what one should do next. And such topics as cloud physics, radio aids to navigation, ionospheric work were discussed and indeed all followed up. Radio astronomy became the most important of the subsequent activities. But it, of course, it in those days was not known as such. I first heard the word radio astronomy from Pawsey in 1948. The word may have been around before then, but I doubt it. I think it was in 1948 that it suddenly appeared. Now, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the background of some of the people. Pawsey had grown up in Melbourne and graduated from Melbourne University, where he obtained a scholarship from the 1851 exhibition. That took him to the Cambridge lab, where he was exposed to Rutherford's viewpoint on how to do physics. His experience there was very noticeable to the large group of people that he subsequently influenced. After Cambridge, he went to work with EMI, Electrical Musical Electrical
Industries,
yeah, and spent 5 years there working on the installation of the transmitting aerials for the for television on Alexandra Palace. So he became an expert on things connected with antennas, following on the ionospheric research that he had done at Cambridge. Then he returned to Sydney in the early days of the war to work in the radiophysics laboratory. In 1962, he was to have become director of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory here in the United States, but unfortunately he died in that year. Now, Pawsey, with MacCready and Ruby Payne Scott, wrote the first Australian paper on observations. Now, Hayes' discovery of solar noise coming across the English Channel in 1942 had become quite well known. That those papers, which were secret, were nevertheless distributed over a network between allied countries. And I used to have fascinating experiences. While I was supposed to be soldering pieces of cable together, I, in fact, would go down to the library to read all this microfilm, which had just arrived by a flying boat from England and would be printed. And the prints were abominable, mostly grey, but nevertheless, the things they were describing were truly fascinating. All about depth charge patterns and the statistics of how to hit submarines. And truly wonderful things. All in addition, we had no reason to know about depth charges. But everything seemed to come. If it was secret, we got it so you could read it. And it was wonderful. So Hayes' discovery of solar noise was quite well known. It must have been equally well known in the United States. And 1945 represented the first effort to look into that phenomenon. So I have a picture here which is suitably historical to show you the antenna that was used for the purpose. It consists of, as you can see quite well, of a great big structure, but it carries only 12 Yagi antennas. There are 12 up here and there are 12 down below that are not really visible, and they're not very good, as you may be able to see from the way they're made. Now, with that antenna, all the results that I'm going to tell you about now came out. It was a height-finding antenna and worked in the following way. Here we see the sort of chart on which height-finding calculations were done. It shows with an antenna here at the origin, and a range going this way, and the height this way, where the lobes of the radiation pattern would be. You can see there's one lobe going out at an elevation angle of about 1 degree, and another lobe at about 2 degrees. Now, an airplane approaching the coast at a height of 10,000 feet would fly through these lobes, you see. It would be seen at that range as it flew through this lobe, then it would disappear, and then it would be seen again flying through that lobe at this range, which is 40 to 50 miles. And from that diagram, and from the appearance and disappearance of the echo from the plane, you could deduce the height. Now, of course, that would be a very long process. So with the lightweight air warning radar, there were two patterns like this. Now, how is this pattern formed? Well, it's formed from the placement of the first antenna I showed you on a cliff, so that we see interference between a ray received directly and a ray received after reflection from the ocean. So these nulls represent cancellation of a direct and a reflected ray. The elevation angles have to do with the height of the antenna above the reflecting surface. Now, if you had a second antenna at a different height, these lobes would move to a somewhat different position. So the height-finding installation comprised two antennas and a reflecting plane. Two antennas, one above the other, and you switched from one antenna to the other, and then you noticed the ratio of amplitudes of the echo being received. And then from a nomogram, you deduced immediately what the height was, with an ambiguity. It might be at 5,000 feet or at 35,000 feet. But 5 minutes later, when you did this again, that ambiguity would disappear. Now, with that antenna, one was able to deal with the problem of explaining what this solar noise must consist of. You see, there were some obvious questions. Did it come from the whole disk of the sun, or did it come from sunspots, or was it related to sunspots, or from the outer atmosphere of the sun? Now, at that time, the antennas being used for radar had beam widths of the order of 10 degrees, in some cases wider. So you see that the experiment to determine where on the sun, which is a half degree in diameter, some radiation was coming with a 10 degree beam width presented a difficult problem. But with the height finding arrangement, it was possible to do that. First measurements were made in October 1945 by Causey MacCready and Ruby Payne Scott. And then in February of 1946, there was a big resurgence of activity, and a sequence of observations was obtained in which the sun, as it rose above the sea horizon, passed successively through the nulls of this interference pattern. And from the times of disappearance of the signal, one could say what the elevation angle of the source was at that moment. And you see the precision is quite comparable with the angular diameter of the sun. So the elevation angle was found on 4 days running, this from this beginning on the 6th of February 1946. And the elevation angle above the horizon of the source of noise was found to be progressing regularly upwards across the face of the sun. And in addition, sunspots were found in those same zones, representing about plus or minus 2 or 3 minutes of arc width simultaneously. Now you see, I have begged the question by telling you that the signal disappeared. The disappearance of the signal showed that the origin of the radiation was from restricted sources of very restricted size and could not have been coming from the whole of the disk of the sun. Now, this discovery has a certain lesson in it for us in if we're planning to make new discoveries in future. It was done with a one-dimensional system which had only resolution in altitude and not in azimuth at all, where the beam width of about 10 degrees would apply. And furthermore, if there had been 2 or 3 sunspot groups on the sun, all of which were emitting, which is quite common, then it would not have led to the situation I've described, where the signal disappeared on the first day of observation, which showed it was a sunspot. So in describing this work, I've sometimes heard an objection raised. People will say, yes, but if there had been 2 or 3 point sources, then this discovery would not have been made. Therefore, we should have built, or one should have built, a more elaborate antenna installation with two-dimensional resolution and better in all ways. The fact of the matter is, of course, next month it would have been discovered, or if not, the month after that. It's just a matter of allowing time to elapse while happy circumstances arise. But in this case, as in many others, the discovery can be made with what would be inadequate equipment for later study. That's been the whole history of many, many of these initial discoveries. The people who came in firstest with the discoveries were the people who got onto it with something that was just good enough and then made the discovery. I should tell you a little bit about Ruby Payne Scott. She was a very dynamic physics graduate, slightly objectionable, abrasive in some ways. And after some experience with observing the sun, she discovered what she referred to as isolated bursts from the sun. Then they came to be called sporadic bursts, and these days they would be called type 3 bursts. But they revealed themselves on the solar record simply as a spike. Whatever else the sun was doing, it would be a spike of such short duration that on the chart recorder there would be no time resolution. It would be just a spike. Now, in 1946, I left Sydney and went to the Cavendish Lab in Cambridge and worked alongside the RALS group. And I used to relay bits of information back and forth. So Ruby had been writing to Martin Ryle saying, what about these isolated bursts? And he had been writing back saying, no, we don't see them. And there had been an interchange of two or three letters of this kind. So finally she published the things, having localized them on the sun also and becoming quite convinced of their existence. And Ryle was denying their existence. So I was working on ionospheric things, and I was detecting solar flares by the influence they were having on the lower ionosphere. And so I had the occasion to go through a lot of Ryle's records looking for comparisons. Now, they were a little bit disappointing. The things that I would measure were for a drop in height of the ionosphere, which were very, very regular, very classically shaped curves, very often exactly the same. And when I would trace the solar record onto my record with the timing the same, sometimes the solar burst would come before, sometimes later, but it would never have the same shape. It would always be of a complex structure. So I had dozens of these things which appeared in my PhD thesis ultimately. And when I got back to Australia in 1950, Ruby wanted to know why Ryle still couldn't see these isolated bursts. According to him, she had sent him one, and he said, that's an airplane. So she wanted to know the full story. So I produced all these records. I had dozens and dozens of feet of Ryle's records, which I'd laboriously traced by hand. And it was riddled with sporadic bursts. He said, there's one, there's one, there's one, there's one. So in 1952, all the Cambridge people except Ryle showed up in Sydney at the IRSI meeting, which was the first meeting of an international union of any kind to go to Australia. And Ruby explained to all the Cambridge people who came, here were the sporadic bursts. Well, it wasn't shortly after they all got back to Cambridge that Ryle wrote to Ruby Payne Scott and said, had I known that Ron Bracewell was secretly tracing my records. So my name was Mutt for the time being. He knew perfectly well I was tracing his records because I was sitting there in his office doing it, getting them out of the drawers. Anyhow, he didn't want me to show them to Ruby. Now, some applications of this technique might be shown. Here's an example of how this directional finding procedure by using null was applied to a simple case of position finding on radiation from a flare. You see, in this case, the resolution is from left to right, and what we see here is the position at that particular time represented by this observation. That's 125. At 130, there's the location. Now, as time elapsed, this radiation was found to move like that. Now, you see, that's very interesting indeed. It's moved right off the disk of the sun. So at this time, at 2 hours, which is half an hour later, we have a source of radiation revealed by direction finding to be in a strip like this. Resolution in the other direction, of course, is not shown. But we see that a very startling discovery there has been made, that the radiation can originate way off the sun. And that, of course, was followed up and led to further work on both type 2 bursts and type 4 and type 5 bursts, which were of long duration and from great elevations. That sort of direction finding work also led to the suspicion that the radio stars, as these objects were coming to be called, might not be radio stars. Here's a little paper entitled Radio Stars or Radio Nebulae. And it shows records of a type obtained on a point source where the interference nulls go right down to nothing. And the individual sources as shown here, this is really an explanatory slide. There must be a little more to it, yes. This shows what happens when you run through a source such as Cygnus A, which will give deep nulls, whereas in the case of Cygnus X, another very strong source at short wavelengths, but which is extended and has since lost its name, does not reveal the interference pattern. Now, the depth of the nulls permits one to say what the angular diameter is. As well as giving the location, it gives an angular diameter, and that was done in the very first sequence of observations on the Sun. And indeed, the 1946 observations also gave the height above the Sun's surface because of the rotation rate being different from the rotation rate for the underlying sunspot. So, most of what I have had to say is concerned with the Sun today in the limited time that I have. But I'd like to say a little bit about the theoretical instrumental developments that came out of that. Right in that very first paper of Pawsey, McCready and Payne-Scott, the Fourier transform concept was already contained. The idea that by measuring the modulation depth or visibility of the interference pattern, one could, by Fourier transformation, get back to information about the source distribution. That later led to the formulation of the concept of complex visibility, which was quite new. Visibility had always meant, as it still does today in optics, the something connected with contrast. But the position of the fringes, which permits you to associate an angle with that amplitude, leads to a complex quantity, without which the full two-dimensional formulation of the Fourier transform relation cannot be made. You don't find that, for instance, in the 1947 paper. It was many years, more than 10 years before the concept of complex visibility enabled that full formulation to be made. In 1954, I was assigned the duty of tidying up the subjects of antenna smoothing, which is the effect that the antenna has on diminishing some of the finer structure in a source, and also strip integration. The solution to the strip integration problem came to be quite well known, and the paper that I and Riddle published on it in the Astrophysical Journal later came to be used and is now used in the brain scanner that EMI invented. So we have a very interesting little piece of feedback. One might say that the experience that Pawsey had gained at EMI and had passed on to me ultimately was fed back in modified form to the source. As you probably know, that I think that my time is up now, and I will stop at that point and stimulate any questions.
Source of technological improvements in many, many other observational sciences. It always amused me that some of the early radio astronomy techniques ended up in submarine warfare.